Religious hardliners in Indonesia once stopped a Lady Gaga concert, but a new generation of Indonesians is pushing back against the growing Middle Eastern influence in what's traditionally been a liberal culture. Hello, I'm Andrew West. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. One of Indonesia's rising media stars tells us about the battle for religious liberty in her country.
Some young generation of Indonesia, they don't necessarily believe in a certain religion, but of course they cannot say that publicly. They would still have the chosen religion on their identity card because that's what's forced by the government.
That's coming up. And while most Australians worry about house prices rising or falling, a coalition of churches says this election campaign cannot ignore the homeless. Within days of the slaughter of 49 people in a gay nightclub in Orlando by a man who'd pledged allegiance to the so-called Islamic State, another man with apparent sympathies for far-right nationalism killed British Labour MP Joe Cox in Birstall in England. Orlando killer Omar Mateen described himself as an Islamic soldier. Ms. Cox's assailant, Thomas Mayer, shouted, "Death to traitors, freedom for Britain," when he appeared in court. Religious and nationalist identities are a factor, but what happens when they converge with a psychological disposition to violence? Tanvir Ahmed is a psychiatrist and writer who's worked in prisons treating extremists. What connections does Dr. Ahmed see in these incidents?
Look, I think Islamism, far right, and even movements like the men's rights movement, they're ideologies of resentment, and they're often the people attracted to them have an experience of personal humiliation and resentment, but they conflate it with politics. It gives them comfort because many of their own faults sometimes they're able to deny, if you like, and then project it outwards, either in the form of let's blame the West for all our problems, or perhaps Muslims or women in the case of men's rights movements.
What do you make of the initial diagnosis, in inverted commas, that Mateen may have been a repressed gay man, marrying this with an ideology of extreme Islam that looks very, very negatively on homosexuality?
There's always a personal dimension. For someone who raised in Islam, and even with a father who supported the Taliban, and the Taliban would have not dissimilar views to the Islamic State on homosexuality. So there's almost certainly a great deal of self-loathing. We don't know for sure that he was gay or not. So on one level, that personal dimension is there. This inability to tolerate himself, extreme self-loathing, inability to sort of face himself in the mirror. Now, we know he married, had wives, yet he may well have been repressed. But that overlaps directly with an ideology of extreme homophobia, where literally where you can't be tolerated, death is acceptable in many Islamic countries. So to try and marry those two together would be very difficult in someone like Mateen. So in some ways, the crime almost certainly had that overlap of personal humiliation or an inability to tolerate himself, which he was then able to project with an ideology that allowed him to almost blame the outside world.
We know very little about Thomas Mayer, the killer of Joe Cox, except his two public statements, in inverted commas, of being Britain first, as he allegedly killed Joe Cox, and then in the courtroom, death to traitors. How do we rationalise or how do we explain his thinking in the same way that we might a religious fundamentalist? I mean, are there similarities there?
I think there's similarities, but I think from the far right, it's probably less coherent. I do think in Islamism, there's a much firmer basis, literally in the text, and a much more grounded history. And I think it has a much stronger foundation in structured beliefs. Whereas I think in the far right, it is more diffuse. The ideas might be centered around some kind of nationalism. For example, for Breivik, it might have been around a Norwegian or a
this
European.
This is Anders Behring Breivik, who killed, I think, you know, 80.
The Norwegian mass killer. And he was quite a challenge for mental health, because initially when he was assessed, he was deemed to have schizophrenia, but there was an outcry over that. And later psychiatrists thought, no, he is not mentally ill. He understood his actions. I don't know the full story of the killer of Joe Cox, but he certainly had overlaps with mental health in the past. I think they certainly have a basis of people who already have a tendencies towards paranoia, towards projection, and want a simple one-catch-all explanation for it. Mm. Now, one thing around mental health, once people get mentally ill, they make links. There's a term called heightened self-reference, where they start making links in the environment with themselves, particularly in a paranoid sense. So they like to try and put a catch cry, one size fits all, one thing explaining everything. And these kinds of ideologies provide that, where almost all their ills, personal or social, they can blame on one specific area.
So we're talking here, what, essentially about a broken psychology. Is that a predisposition to being attracted to an extremist ideology?
Look, I think so. That doesn't necessarily mean that these ideologies themselves are unsound, or they will often be driven by people who are far from mentally ill, if you like. Like the leaders in many ideologies, be it Marxism or Islamism or the far right, will be very coherent. You know, they may be extremely intelligent, but they are ultimately ideologies of protest and resentment and projection. Mm. They're really about the current world is terrible, is wrong. We need to smash the current setup, if you like, and recreate some sort of utopian thinking. So their ideology of protest, and people who are already angry and feel they've been wronged in some form are far more likely to be attracted to these kinds of ideologies.
But relatively few people take up and make this a violent quest. I mean, even when we talk about radical Islam, the majority of radical Islamists don't get violent. They get angry, they get resentful. What in the case of Mateen, and to what extent we know anything about Mia, what pushes them towards the actual violence beyond the welled-up resentment that can be managed?
Look, certainly not one path. So I think in extremism, you get some people who are already violent. So you have many, particularly in converts, some people in jails that you see who may have had a past history of, say, gang violence, were never particularly religious, but then sort of put on the cloak of Islamism. It gives them a bit of a justification in some ways, or it's almost a type of redemption. It gives their violence a more meaning. So there's one set of people who are already violent, then put on the cloak of this ideology. And Mateen arguably had a pre-existing history of violence. We know he was engaged in domestic violence. But I think there is another path of people who had no predisposition to violence in the past. And many Islamic terrorists, be it Jihadi John, the San Bernardino killers, the London bombers, most of them had no pre-existing history of violence. But they began in non-violent extremism. So they had a set of beliefs which over time were hardened in a narrow sort of setting. And that's really what radicalization is about, where people become isolated and then their views are hardened and then given a firm, cohesive, purposeful direction in the form of violence. So I think there's separate paths that people come to it by. In the case of Mateen, I think he already had a predisposition to violence.
Yeah. What about the roles of families here? Again, we know very little about Thomas Meir's family, but we increasingly know a lot about Omar Mateen's family. His father, as you said, was a supporter of the Taliban. To what extent does family have some impact on the formation of that ideology and then that violent psychology?
I think one of the biggest myths we have at the moment is that Islamic State has this extraordinary propaganda machine where people are radicalized within days, almost from some sort of pure brain state. I think often many people in the Muslim community have already been exposed to many of these ideas. So I would argue there's a whole lot of views that we might call non-violent extremism. And arguably extremism is the wrong word, because I think it's far less extreme in many of these communities. Now, the vast majority are not interested in violence and they would actively oppose that kind of violence. But those set of ideas to be pushed into violence, it's far more easy but to radicalize into violence having that foundation. You could call them low-hanging fruit, if you like.
Yeah.
It's far more easy to be tipped into violence when you already have that foundation of significant support for many of the ideas that radical Islam holds.
That poses a big challenge, and you've talked about this before, and I've heard you speak publicly about it, to de-radicalization programs. This suggests that if people aren't radicalized, you know, within days on the internet, as seems to be, you know, some of the conventional thinking, if it's a much more deeply rooted process, I assume then de-radicalization is an equally difficult task.
Look, it's a very emerging field, if you like. So there's various ideas around it. So by and large, in the Western world, not too much what we term de-radicalization. We're actually attempting to change the views of terrorists. Not a great deal of that has been done successfully. And really what we're doing is a term called disengagement. We're really trying to shift them from being violent extremists, to nonviolent extremists. Now, it doesn't sound very inspiring, but one of the most successful programs in history was from Arafat. Mm. And what he did was a specific
Arafat
group.
And the Palestinian Liberation.
They were called
Liberation
the Black September Wing, and they were this extreme wing of the PLO, and they'd conduct assassinations, hijackings, the most violent tasks, and they were the most committed group. And when Arafat needed a degree of sheen, if you like, more kind of mainstream respectability, he needed to do away with this group in the sense that he needed them not to conduct in such violence. And what he did was he bought them flash property in Lebanon, found them the most beautiful women and got them to marry, and then paid them to have kids. So suddenly they were kind of flushed into domestic bliss and they've lost motivation to act in violence. And it's regarded as one of the most successful de-radicalisation programs. But that's really what we're attempting to do in the Western world. Now, there's certainly attempts at de-radicalisation elsewhere, but the success is limited. It varies. And often they need to use past terrorists, etc. But in Australia, we're basically attempting disengagement with limited results. And the most recent attacker on Anzac Day, he was in one of these programs for over 12 months with little success.
Great to talk to you, Dr. Tanvir Ahmed, psychiatrist and writer. Thank you very much for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thanks very much, Andrew.
Australia's biggest service providers to the homeless are faith-based. Anglicare, Mission Australia, the Salvos, Vinnies, Uniting Care, the Wesley Mission. And during this election campaign, they've pointed out that on any given night, more than 100,000 Australians sleep rough. And that figure includes 44,000 children and young people. In a petition and joint letter, they're asking the Coalition, Labor and the Greens to halve homelessness by 2025, a realistic target, they say. Well, last week, staff and clients met representatives of the three major parties. Our producer, Nadia Elgorli, went along and spoke first with Catherine Yeomans of Mission Australia.
What we know is in the last federal budget, the government hasn't made provision to fund homelessness services beyond June 2017. But we can't have this uncertainty. Housing providers don't know whether they're going to be able to keep supporting people who find themselves homeless beyond June 2017. We actually need people to put this as a national priority and make sure that we have funding that's required. For periods of time, funding should really be going in five-year blocks. Over the last few years, we've only had funding for 12 months at a time. The last one was renewed for 2 years. This is just not appropriate for an issue that is affecting so many people right across the country.
We actually need to be able to lock local government, state government and federal government in a room and not let them out until they've solved this issue. It is solvable. I mean, that's the exciting thing. We know that we are able to turn many, many of those people's lives around.
That's Casey Chambers, Executive Director of Anglicare. And before her, Mission Employment Chief Executive Officer Catherine Yeomans. The charities say homelessness could be fixed with strong political leadership and a comprehensive national action plan to tackle the lack of affordable housing and services on the front line. Casey Chambers again.
The issue is that public housing stock has been going down. Our population is growing. And obviously, there's a gap. The Property Supply Council recently estimated that we have a shortfall of about 500,000 dwellings. We need to make sure that the housing we build is actually meeting the needs of the people who are homeless or needing housing. So we do need some single bedroom dwellings. We need community housing. We need housing where people can live in community together. We need a number of options. We do a rental affordability snapshot every year where we actually look at one weekend at every rental property on the market in Australia. So this year we looked at over 75,500 properties. Now, if you were a single person on government benefits that weekend in April, if you were a single person on the age pension, 2.1% would be affordable. And if you were on Newstart or Youth Allowance, there was one property out of 75,500 properties that was affordable. What's happening is because we've got this shortfall of supply, people who would have been buying houses are now renting, people who would have been renting are in public or affordable housing, then it skews the whole system. So we've got everything from people not being able to afford to buy houses down to affordable rent that is just pretty hopeless if you were looking for an affordable rental on that weekend that we surveyed, right through to a huge shortage of public housing.
The government says the coalition has provided $230 million over 2 years. That's matched by states and territories to fund frontline services, with priority given to women and children experiencing family violence and homeless youth. And there has been no move yet to renegotiate the National Partnership Agreement on Housing, which provides funding to services until a COAG report on reforms to housing and homelessness is out at the end of this year. Meanwhile, Labor says the Turnbull government has cut $132 million from homelessness services, and that certainty around funding is crucial. Its housing policy pledges to make housing more affordable and to look at long-term funding. The Greens say they will double federal funding to homelessness services for the next 10 years. Mission Australia's Catherine Yeoman and Anglicare's Casey Chambers say that the people most vulnerable and most at risk of homelessness are easy to identify.
Actually, a lot of homelessness is hidden. So it will be people who are couch surfing, people who are living in their car, people might be accessing short-term crisis accommodation or staying in motels. There's many faces of homelessness, and it can be families, children, and increasingly older people as well.
The trend for government funding has increasingly focused on large organisations, which has meant smaller or niche organisations miss out. I asked Casey Chambers if the lack of diversity of services to the homeless, such as small organisations catering to local or specialist need, raises concerns for her.
It certainly does. At Anglicare, we've got a number of members who are very small, and all of our services started small. But also, the fact of small agencies and their survival seems to be really important at the moment. We are hearing from government that smaller agencies are not who they want to deal with necessarily, that there are issues of viability. There's huge amounts of red tape that all agencies have to jump through. That is more difficult if you're a smaller agency. There's no doubt about that. But the energy that's in a small agency is really something. The fact that they involve their community, that brings a greater depth to services. One of the reasons for supporting a number of small organisations is because we want a diversity of service providers so that people have a choice. If they don't want to come to Anglicare, they don't have to. The other thing is that the things that bring us to those services are often to do the work because of our faith and because of our values base. They're not to actually seek to gain people into the church. So we would certainly support lots of services, diversity of services, so that people don't have to use church-based services. But I would say that most Anglicare services do not look like an outwardly Christian service. Other than that, they are living out the values of Jesus and Christianity.
Yeah, I'm Tibi Aubrey, and I'm at university at ACU doing philosophy and blogging.
Each year, more than 200,000 Australians seek help from homelessness services. And according to figures released in March, a record 486 people are sleeping rough on the streets of central Sydney alone. Tibi Aubrey is one. Australian-born, he grew up in France, but returned to Australia homeless after leaving his job as a stockbroker in Paris. His story exemplifies the trap that homeless people find themselves in and is the sort of story that support services like Mission Australia and the Salvation Army hear every day.
I was homeless in Perth to start with when I came to Perth where I was born. I brought a van and that was actually kind of a plan. I'm going to live in a van and I'm going to work doing the fruit pickings, and everything went okay until I got fined many times because I was sleeping in my van, which is illegal. That started to be a problem because more I was working and more I was losing money, so it didn't make any sense, and I lost my van. I thought it was the end. I ended up in Sydney and someone picked me up one day and put me in a rehab. I've done 9 months of rehab and I got rid of alcohol. And I came to Mission Australia. And I discovered also that they had this university introduction to university units. That's the place I need to be. Now I'm in university. It's still troubling for me. Even I'm on housing and I thank Mission Australia and I can do this university stuff. But I'm just saying it's not, the story is not finished.
Nadia Telgulli speaking with formerly homeless man Tibby Albury. And you're with Andrew West on the Religion and Ethics Report. In a recent interview with Atlantic magazine, Barack Obama revealed a major grievance against Saudi Arabia, the effect it's having on Indonesia. Obama spent 4 years of his childhood in Indonesia, and he's watched how the local Islam has moved from a relaxed religion to something more unforgiving. That's his word. Obama blamed the influx of money from hardline Saudi sources. It's a trend observed by Indonesian journalist Marissa Anita, and she's been in Australia on a Department of Foreign Affairs Elizabeth O'Neill scholarship, and Marissa Anita joined me earlier.
I was born to a Muslim mother and a Catholic father, and I have two brothers, one older and one younger. My older brother is Catholic, I'm Catholic, but my younger brother is Christian.
Yes, a Protestant Christian.
Yes. It's definitely very interesting growing up because, to tell you the truth, there was a bit of tug of war actually between my mom and dad, because my mom's side of the family would like me to be a Muslim, would like the kids to be Muslims, but my dad put us to Catholic schools, so I ended up being a Catholic. Yes.
How common are such families and such relationships, interfaith relationships in Indonesia?
Well, actually, I know that there's actually a lot of interfaith couples, especially young couples in Indonesia. But the problem is Indonesia does not acknowledge different faith marriage. So it has actually been a problem because there were some people who are actually right now fighting for a regulation that would actually allow interfaith marriages. Because it's actually something that has happened over the years. When my dad and my mom got married, my dad had to convert to Islam. But that's pretty much just for the marriage, to make the marriage process easier. But after they received the certificate, my father would actually convert back to Catholicism. Yes.
Is that a common process? Because you're right, I think the Indonesian law requires you to identify with one of the six official religions.
Yes, that's correct. Some young generation of Indonesia have actually evolved a bit more. So they don't necessarily believe in a certain religion, but of course they cannot say that publicly. They would still have the chosen religion on their identity card because that's what's forced by the government.
Yeah. I mean, what are the six official faiths?
The six official faiths are Islam, Catholic, Catholicism, and Protestant, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Confucius.
And is it true that it's, strictly speaking, illegal to say that you're an atheist?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I remember several years ago, there was a story of a person who created a Facebook page for atheism in Indonesia. And then immediately that person was in a lot of trouble. So it's absolutely illegal to announce yourself as an atheist, even though there are atheist people in Indonesia. But they just don't say it out loud.
Now, Marissa, Indonesia is officially a multi-faith country. That's embodied in the national ideology of Pancasila. But is Pancasila officially or in any way under threat?
Yes, I was talking about it in Bhinneka Tunggal Ika, which is unity and diversity in Indonesia, that it's getting less and less known by the younger generation. And that is very dangerous because Indonesia is actually strengthened. Our unity is strengthened by that ideology. And now there is this movement, whether we want to admit it or not, but we do start to feel it, which is the Arabization of of Islam in Indonesia. Now, the Arab principle may not really fit Indonesians because we cannot be homogenized.
Yeah. Well, a vast archipelago, I think something like 30,000 islands or something.
And, yeah, exactly.
And I've probably, you know, understated it. But when you talk about the Arabization of Indonesia, we're talking here about the very thing that Barack Obama identified in a recent article in the Atlantic Monthly, and that is the use of Arab money, especially from Saudi Arabia, to fund radical madrasas? I mean, is that what you're talking about?
Well, that's what I hear definitely whenever I speak to people around me, that there is that influence as well and the money coming in as well. Oftentimes, this is my personal experience, it's just such a stark thing to see when I see like a poor neighborhood and suddenly there is this huge, huge and grand mosque smack bang right in the middle of it. That for me just feels a bit or seems a bit strange.
Yeah. How does this Arabization show up in everyday life? I mean, especially in something as obvious as the veil.
Right. Well, it's as simple as this. When I was growing up, I would have Muslim friends around me as well. Even though I was in a Catholic school, we would have Muslim students as well. Back then, whenever the Catholics or the Christians celebrate Christmas, you know, the Muslim students, it would be so natural for them to say, Happy Christmas, because that's Indonesia. And whenever the Muslims celebrate Eid al-Fitr or the Eid, it would be so natural for us, the Christians, to say Happy Eid al-Fitr, because my mom is a Muslim, so I would say that to her. But recently, probably around in the past 5 years, suddenly there's this regulation saying some of them, not all of them, but some of them are forced to not say Happy Christmas to the Christians.
Yeah.
And I feel very sad because this is Indonesia. We become Indonesia because we're uniting. We forget about the differences. We respect each other. We respect the differences. And we get on with each other.
But I found very interesting your observation that when you were a child, maybe 1 in 20 women wore the veil. What would you estimate it is today?
I don't know the exact numbers, but more and more people wear the veil. And it's actually okay to wear the veil as long as the reason is, you know, it's for the right reason. Because oftentimes women wear the veil, they wear the veil for many, many, many reasons. One, it's because of peer pressure. Two, it's because of family pressure. Three, of course, it's from within, because I've spoken to women who said that it's from within. It's my calling. Fourth, sometimes there's the pressure from men, either it's from their husbands or their boyfriends. Those are some of the reasons that I know why women would wear veil in Indonesia.
Yeah. The other area where the rising tide of conservative Islam is noticeable is in popular culture. What happened when Lady Gaga wanted to perform in Indonesia?
Yeah, right. There is this group called the Front Pembela Islam, which is the Islamic Defenders Front. If I'm not mistaken, they demonstrated against Lady Gaga. It's actually a little bit more complex, and I don't know whether I should say it or not. But basically, Front Pembela Islam, or the Islamic Defenders Front, which do not represent the Muslims in Indonesia, by the way. It was oftentimes they're considered thugs, even by the Muslims in Indonesia. A lot of Muslims in Indonesia are not happy with their presence. But unfortunately, sometimes these good people are the silent majority. So that's why such a group that promotes violence still exists in Indonesia. But right now, we actually have a governor, the governor of Jakarta, which is Pak Basuki Cahayapurnama, or Ahok. He has been controlling this group actually very well, because usually during the Ramadan leading up to the Eid al-Fitr, these thugs, FPI, would actually raid entertainment places. They would destroy these places. And, of course, it's a very criminal act. Yeah. It's a criminal act.
So what happened to Lady Gaga? Was she allowed on stage?
No. In the end, she was not. She didn't come to Jakarta in the end.
Indonesian journalist Marissa Anita, who's won the Department of Foreign Affairs Elizabeth O'Neill Scholarship. And she ends this week's Religion and Ethics Report. Thanks to Nadia Telgorley, our producer, and technical producer Tim Jenkins. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.